Good evening, I'm Uma Paganampakepagan alongside Richard Bradbury, and have we got a show for you today. Toka Hong is a journalist, playwright and movie star. He runs Scoop Books. He served 14 years in the New Straits Times. He used to write an eating out column under the pseudonym Fats, and lately he's gone a little Hollywood in Showtime's production of Marco Polo. So Thor, you grew up in Brickfield.
Yes.
Tell us about Brickfield's growing up. Growing up in Brickfields then and now, I mean, it's changed so much, it's become a bit of an abomination.
Mm-hmm. It is. I was there, well, I was actually born in Kampung Pandan for the first few months of my life was there, but after that my father got a house in the 100 quarters right opposite the Vivekananda Ashram.
Yeah.
And that was, so I lived there from 1950 till 1973 or 74. When my father then retired from the civil service. So,
oh, very nice. My dad grew up right opposite as well. You were probably neighbors. Maybe not around the same time. I think my dad moved out in the 60s, but yeah.
I was in the second block, 7th house. Yeah, yeah. I was right opposite there. And then Chinatown Field at the back was where, you know, quite a few Malaysian footballers grew up and things like that.
Right.
It was a nice place. And Gopal Shetty was teaching Indian dance in the ashram. Now it's become, well, generations later, the Temple of Fine Arts.
Yeah, of course.
Further down the road.
So how does a kid born in Kampung Pandan, growing up in the 100 quarters, end up becoming a playwright, end up in film? Why aren't you an accountant, Thor?
I have no idea because, when I finished my sixth form in the Victoria Institution, yeah, I had the option when I was applying to university of doing either economics or what else? Oh, yeah, law. But I thought law was boring because everyone thinks law is lawyers posturing, Perry Mason, defending, saving innocent souls from jail. And I knew that, it's a lot of memorizing precedents and cases and all that. I said, no, more studying. I don't want to do that.
Right.
And somehow I never had quite got into economics. And so I said, and I always had a fond, even though my family was not exactly well off, dad always, whatever money he could spare, he would buy the Penguin crime series. So even by the time I was 7, I was reading all the Agatha Christie's and Peter Cheney's and James Callahan and stuff like that, and even Mickey Spillane, though my uncle told my father that Mickey Spillane was not the appropriate reading material for a 7-8-year-old kid. Because I found things like, I read through every single Secret Seven and Famous Five stuff, and we had our own Secret Seven clubhouse in Brickfields and stuff like that. But I don't know, it just, there was no TV. So I devoured my Enid Blyton's in like 2 hours, and then it's like, what do I do? Okay, read it from page one all over again.
All over again.
So
yeah.
I had that reading habit I'm glad that for whatever money he could spare. And in fact, after a while, my dad subscribed to Beano and Dandy for me. So every issue that came out, I got it.
Oh, that's very interesting because even for me, Dandy and Beano were my parents' trick. It was the gateway drug to more reading.
Yeah. Agreed. Right? Absolutely exactly the same. Back home with my parents as well, it got to the point where Beano and Dandy were the thing. Beza as well was another one.
Yeah, Beza, Topper.
Yeah, and my dad was like, for my punishment, it wasn't you're not allowed to go out and play. It was I'm taking away your comics.
That's right. If you're not studying, you haven't done your homework, it's like after first warning, second warning, okay, that's it. For the next 2 days, locked up.
Yeah.
And the newspaper man would deliver it here as well.
Yeah.
Every week, you know, without fail, we'd get a copy of the Dandy and the Beano.
I mean, we used to call my uncle Desperate Dan. But I mean, Thor, how did you go from like a kid who clearly imagination is running wild at that age? You're 7 years old, you know. Mm-hmm. What as you're going through school and you're going through this whole period of you're learning, you're doing all these. What made you decide I don't want to be an accountant? I don't want to be a lawyer. Like you're saying, it was boring. Mm-hmm. You know. How do you suddenly go, right, I want to act, I want to write, I want to direct? Was it something you consciously decided to do, or was it like I fell into it?
No, I just wanted something to do with literature and writing. Acting came much later when I went into the university. In my school, the VI, acting was reserved for a certain elite group. So they never had auditions or anything, and I couldn't quite get into it. I only got into it when I went to the university, but I always was writing something, or I was doing writing for my primary school magazine, my essays. I still have them buried somewhere in the amount of rubbish I have at home, but they were sort of like my own version of Secret Seven stories, dealing with atomic spies and buried treasure and that kind of stuff. So I just started like that, and then I just knew I wanted to get more into literature, and which was like with my usual bad sense of timing. I went into University of Malaya to do literature in 1970, 1 year after May 13th.
Right.
And even then, within the university, there was a move to shut down the English department because it was considered one of the last vestiges of colonial imperialism, mental brainwashing kind of thing. And there was all that thing going on. But I said, nope, I wanted to go in and do literature. Then I went in and then found...
How old were you then, by the way?
I went into university, I was 20.
Right.
Yeah, 20.
You know what's interesting? So you come from there's a generation of Malaysians that that are your contemporaries that almost, it led the way for us growing up in the 80s and the 90s with regards to theatre, with regards to film, with regards to television. And then something happened. We lost the generation. Now there seems to be a little creative spurt amongst Malaysians. Mm-hmm. But there was a period, I think, between the late 90s and early 2000s where we seem to have lost the generation. So what happened in the 80s and the 90s, in your opinion, that stopped all of this creative output, this vast creative output?
I think it's partly to do with the educational system. Because I think I was lucky in the sense I caught the tail end of University of Malaya before it became really dry and dreary and grey and they clamped down. I mean, can I use the word sex?
Of course, yes.
It was the hippie movement, the love generation. We went in and we had freedom to do whatever we wanted. I remember friends staging scenes from Macbeth under the trees at night.
Really?
Things like that,
Wow.
And nobody clamped down on us. We could do whatever we wanted.
It sounds like a different place, you know.
It does. Yeah. I can't find people who can spell Macbeth right now. That's my problem. But carry on.
But by the time I started doing my master's in 73, 74, the Islamization, the clamping down had started happening, and then even the society that was working with a lot, the literary society in the English department, you started having to apply for permission to even have a tea party or a seminar or whatever. And I remember the first week, my second day when I was in the University of Malaya as a freshie, and I saw this notice stuck up that said, "Oh, tonight the visiting Fulbright professor will be discussing the lyrics of Simon and Garfunkel." Wow. And I went up there, and there were all the students with guitars, and we were doing Sounds of Silence and all that kind of stuff and other unmentionable things, which I cannot say on the air. But
we can guess.
And there was this Fulbright professor, whom later I knew, found out was one of the world's top authorities on Herman Melville and Moby Dick and all that. And there he was, he was in his 60s, he had white hair down to his shoulders, he was in bell bottoms and a t-shirt and all that. And I said, "Huh? He's a Fulbright professor?" it was cool. I mean, for those first 3-4 years, it was great. I mean, every weekend the students would organize a whole night of rock bands in Dewan Tunku Chance. I mean, we were allowed to do that. They would go down to the Union House and ask the satay man, "Okay, prepare 5,000 sticks of satay." Anchor Beer would be very happy to do those days. Draft beer was first introduced, so they gave it to us at like a major discount, and the students were selling it $5 entry. You get two top rock bands, Grim Preachers or the Strollers or whatever, and you come out, you got cheap beer, satay. Everyone was happy. But then by 73, 74, all that is like decadence, and they started clamping down on that. So, yeah. And then so you lost, I suppose you lost that initiative, the willingness, because too much red tape.
Mm.
Which was also one of the reasons why then I moved out, because it's just like, you have to sit through interminable, boring staff meetings, the kind of thing, to decide on resupply of paper and paper clips kind of thing. It's like,
so it just became a frustration. You just like, I don't want to do it anymore because it's too much hard work almost.
Mm. I got into theatre because I was disappointed with my English studies. It just wasn't quite what I wanted. There were some great lecturers, but there were also some really tedious, boring ones.
Right.
So then I heard, there was a theatre class going on. I said, okay, I'll go in and see what it's all about. And I suppose it's natural from when I was a kid in Brickfields. I was a pirate of the Caribbean. I was Robin Hood. I was an astronaut and all that. So it just very naturally, it's like, okay. And it's now on a higher level. And now I'm doing John Osborne's scripts and Harold
that Pinter kind, and stuff. Richard, if you don't know, that kind of escapism happens when you hang around Indians too much. We're speaking today to actor, playwright, journalist and Renaissance man, Thaw Ka Hong. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to the Evening Edition with Richard and Uma, and today we're going inside the mind of Thaw Ka Hong.
Around this point, kind of 1971-ish, 72, 73, yeah, you directed a play, you won an award, right?
Yeah, that was my second year, and I was too naive or young to realize that, just after a year of sort of like theatre classes that I'm qualified to direct. But that year, the Literary and Dramatic Society, every year they sent an entry into the Malaysian Drama Festival, and that year was the third Malaysian Drama Festival. And just about, I think, 6 weeks before the festival, the director, Chan Ming Lai, who then later subsequently became famous as the pimp in, what's that, Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, Saigon.
Miss Saigon.
Miss Saigon.
Yeah.
Yeah, on Broadway. So he quarreled with the producer and he stormed out. So suddenly there was no director. So they were scrambling around the producer, and then they said, oh, there's this crazy Chinaman in the second year, you know, why don't you ask him? And he said, I said, okay. So, but the problem was trying to find a script with a small cast, because very few people wanted to do theatre.
Right.
So we had to figure out, and then every time we had an auditions, 26 to 30 girls would show up, and one guy.
And one guy, yeah.
And then you had to go around a whole arts concourse, and then, hey, want an egg? Ah, waste of time, I just want to drink beer. Leave me alone, that kind of thing. So I found
Didn't use the girls as a selling point? There's all these girls. You
know? I stumbled onto Christopher Hampton's script, When Did You Last See My Mother? And that was also his first script. And we entered it, and it turned out that in the finals, the other English entry, the other finalist, was my drama lecturer, who was also lecturing in UITM Shah Alam.
Wow.
And we took Mustafa Noor, who subsequently became a very famous actor, and he was already at the time actually a TV singer, quite a famous singer, performing for TV Singapore and people like that, singing with Anita Sarawak and all that. He got into theatre too at the same time as I did. So he made his debut as an actor. I made my debut as a director. And he took Best Actor and I took Best Director, and we got the Best Production, beating out my own lecturer.
How did that feel?
Amazing. We thought we were the greatest. We were good enough to be equal to Olivier and Gilgut and Richardson. Yeah, 21, you're just stupid. And then a few months later, the University of Singapore heard about it and contacted us and said, we heard you got this production that's won all these awards. Why don't you come and stage it in the University of Singapore? So we said, great, yeah, our first international tour. And we did it. And then I remember one morning my father shaking me up from sleep and pointing to the front page of the Straits Times, and the day before the Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew had banned the production, and for various reasons. One of which was that one of the lead characters was a homosexual, and that the script did not portray, did not show any overt disapproval
of it.
Of it. And of course, there were a couple of four-letter words, and then there was a monologue that sort of made fun of Jesus Christ. So I remember even the line like saying that the script contained language from the gutter, and therefore anyone who is involved in this production must be from the gutter. My father kept a straight face. I was looking at that and I was saying, you must be thinking, my son, I sent him to university and now the
prime minister. Now he's from the gutter.
Yes, and the prime minister of the Singapore says he's from the gutter.
So wait, tell me, Thor, what year was this?
71.
It's amazing that it's 2014 now. Mm-hmm. And you know, the new regulations, Malaysian regulations, are if you depict homosexualities in film or on theatre, mm-hmm. they must either repent at the end or die. So nothing's changed since from 1971 to 2014.
Well, it might not make first page, front page news.
Oh, not anymore, right? Now with
I don't know.
Wow. But yeah, speaking of glory days gone, talk to us about your days at the New Straits Times. You worked for many, many years at the New Straits Times.
About 13 years. I joined as a lead writer in 1980, and I also started, I was given 72 hours notice and a staff of two to start the second section of the paper, which was called at the time called Times 2.
Times 2, yeah.
Yeah, and then and also at various other things. I also wrote...
You did a food part as well, didn't you, as well?
Had a pen name called Fats. Yes, I did a food review thing, which was... people had the image that Fats was a 260-pound slob who belched all the time, picked his nose, and people didn't know there was this skinny Chinaman who was... that it was actually me. And then it sort of had a life of its own, and then people would ask requests for what these 260-pound fats look like. And once in a while, I'd go into our files and dig up
some
fat
guy.
American guy from the back so you couldn't see the face, you know. We're just like, that's fats. You want to have a look at him, that
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
That kind. And even actually, I was surprised that a Canadian lecturer was lecturing in Taylor's College. He was such a fan. He sent all my columns to the Toronto Globe and Mail, and next thing I knew, the Toronto Globe and Mail food columnist did a whole column on me.
Wow.
Things like that. Yeah, that had actually three separate, periods it appeared. And then after a while, I got tired of eating. And it was a chore being an editor, and I was also the senior Lilo writer and things like that. And then sometimes you're finishing work at 8-9 o'clock at night, and then you say, oh no, I've got a column to do tomorrow, now where can I go and eat? And you really don't want to go out and eat, you just want to go home and just crash out, you know, that kind of thing. So I stopped it, and then the boss said, no, you cannot stop it, and it started again, and so it went on like that. And then after a while I said, enough is enough.
No, and I think that's one of the most interesting things about that period of time. That would be the time in which I was growing up and reading the NST all the time. You guys had a very vibrant lit pages, very vibrant food, cinema. This kind of secondary commentary on people's lives and the things they love is lacking in almost all of our newspapers these days.
That was also because, again, maybe because I was lucky, I caught the tail end in the university of a certain generation and a certain ethos. In the NST, I think up to the mid-80s, there was a great bunch of people there too. When I joined, I mean, I was with Munir Majid, who later became chairman of MAS and other sort of things. And we were the two so-called bachelor leader writers. My first boss was Tan Sri Lee, now passed on, dear man. And he was old school enough to say that unmarried staff
don't have to go home.
No, got to work on Sundays,
yes,
so that the married people can spend time with the family. So Muni and I was like, we had great fun. And then later Raymond Rashid joined us, and people like Halina and Supriya, who were all great writers in their own way. So it was a great bunch. We were feeding off each other, and you could see each other's writings. So it's like, okay, you know, that, he's writing like that. So and we were developing our own styles, our own characters, and that it was a great time, you know. But then again, things I won't go into happened, and then it's and after like 13 years, I just said,
enough.
It's a chore. There was no fun. Actually, in my last 2 years, I wasn't doing anything. I was asked to form the senior feature writers team. And for once, I insisted, I told the bosses, every time you tell me to do a project, and then you lumber me with certain people that none of the other desks want, then I have to live with them. This time, if you say you want a senior features team, I will pick the writers. So I picked Kamro, Idris, and people like that who were good writers. So it's like, I had no work to do. I didn't have to worry about the language. You know, I strolled in, I disturbed everyone else, and they want to go out for tea, that kind of thing. And then they just tell me, they say, like, "Oh, Thor, I can't do the thing today. I'll get it tomorrow." I just knew they were mature, responsible people. I left it at that. So I come in, then they say, "Okay, it's in the system." I looked at it in half an hour. I've cleared it, everything. I said, send it to the subs, and I'm wandering around again. Hey, want to go for teh tarik? So after about 2 years of that, my wife still berates me once in a while for that. And says, like, you were earning a good salary there, and you gave it all up. And isn't it that everyone in life says, I want a job that pays me well and I don't have to do anything? You finally reach that point. You were fairly well paid, and at the time I was still not married. And then you don't have to do any work. I mean, you just did about half an hour a day. I mean, it's all an hour a day. And you're complaining? I said, yeah, because after 2 years of that, I was brain dead.
Okay. Yeah. No, crazy. It's interesting because, and thank God for the internet for this, right, that I still go back to a lot of the writing that took place at that time. Your writing, Rayman's, Kamral's, Saleh Benjonet's. I have the book, which you guys published at school. It's frightening. You read Saleh's As I Please, his collection of essays, and I swear to God, if you change the date on it, it could apply to today.
Right.
The commentary is that, not to say timeless, I think our politics is so cyclical, but it's that timeless, right? Which is quite fascinating. We don't seem to have that kind of caliber. Thor Ka Hung is in the house. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan. I'm here with Richard Bradbury, and today we're speaking to Thor Ka Hung. He's a journalist, he's a playwright, he runs a bookshop, he's all Hollywood in Marco Polo.
The last time that I saw you, I think, was 2011, is when I was working on the weekend team at the time, fairly new to BFM, and they said, we'd like you to go and interview this guy called Thor. We hear he's a bit of a character. We hear he can be a bit argumentative and a bit temperamental. And yet, when I walked into Scoop Books, it's perhaps one of my most favorite interviews I've done, because you were just like one of these characters that just opened up. You know, you told your stories like they were, and I really, really liked that, because a lot of the other people that I'd interviewed were quite reticent, they were reserved, they had this like filter already put in place, and it made them less fun to interview, you know.
Well, Thor was my first descent into the dark side as a child. You see, my first experience with Scoop Books was that's where I went to find a copy of Satanic Verses.
Wow.
I think I was 14 or 15 years old, and I had heard about this. And of course, everyone told me, hey, the uncle in the shop, very scary. So, but yes, that was my first experience with Scoop Books.
Right.
And he sold me illegal goods.
But I mean, so tell us about how you got involved with Scoop Books and Ike Ong and the whole thing. How did it happen?
Well, as I said, I was getting a bit tired of working for NST. I mean, I wasn't being engaged mentally. And then when Scoop Books started in Bangsar, which was just around the corner from the NST, I was there every day. Every evening I finished work, I was there, and I was spending like a couple of $100 and nothing else to spend on. So I was like giving up drinking, kind of getting my drunken binges. So it's like I had money. So I was spending a couple of $100. And Alan, who started it, the Malaysian partner for Scoop Books, he was working with Scoop Books in London as an accountant. And then he had to come back with his sister because the mum was getting on.
Right.
So he started Scoop Books here. But he was an accountant by training. And he was really interested in all kinds of other things. But he took on, because Ike initially said, nah, nobody reads in Malaysia. A bookshop wouldn't work in Malaysia. But Alan said, give me a chance and I'll try and do it. So Alan, we became good friends every evening. And he'd see me browsing through stuff. And then he said, look, you know your books. And you're not just literature, I was buying history and philosophy and all that kind of stuff. He said, you know books more than I do. And then you're here every day and you're spending so much money. He says, why don't you just buy all the whole damn thing? And I said, oh, yeah, okay. I thought about it and I did it.
And that's that. How's things going over at Scoob now?
Fairly neglected, actually, because since I've been working for the Malaysian Insider for just over a year. So the customers will give me a buzz, and because when I'm online, you know, it's difficult to deal with customers. Mm. So depending on my shift, but yeah, it's still there, and people still drop in. But most of the time now, people are dropping in to try and sell me novels. They think I'll just take in. I said no, I'm not. But if you've got out of print Malaysiana antiquarian books, yes, I'll look at it. You know, but otherwise, you know.
Mm.
And I find that now. I think when Scoop first opened in the 90s into the 2000 something, there were still customers coming in who would be asking for Charles Bukowski or William Burroughs. Da, 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 da. I think the people that come in now into Scoop have no clue who these people are. Even D.H. Lawrence, never heard of him.
Mm.
All that, it's all gone. History. So it's sad in that way. They are now looking, oh, the latest Booker Prize winner and that kind of thing. That's all they want, or the latest.
Which they have Dan on Brown. The shelf, but they don't actually read.
The latest Dan Brown, do you have that kind of thing? That's all they're asking for. But no longer anybody asking for, do you have this out of print Charles Bukowski? There's still one guy who's been bugging me, and I said, look, I can't get you any Charles Bukowski now, but I'll try. And I said, well, you're the last person in KL who's looking for Charles Bukowski. Actually, I find Charles Bukowski very boring.
Yeah.
It's all the books read alike. It's start on page one and you're drunk, and the last page you're still drunk, and the next book, yeah, it's another drunken binge.
How much of it has to do with accessibility now? I mean, I guess people have other access to Bukowski, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can go yeah, to eight books.
No, I think it's just that people don't even. As I said, for me, it's like, I had to study D.H. Lawrence in school, secondary school itself. And then I wound up in university as, oh no, it's Sons and Lovers again, that kind of thing. But it's like all those writers now, I suppose maybe it's the English influence is sort of...
I don't know. I think what it is, it's because of the larger bookstores. They've come in and they said, like, this is what we are selling to you. You know, and it's not so much you have this great choice of somewhere like Scoob or the older kind of bookstores, you have a very limited selection. And even when you go to them and say, do you have this book? Could you check for me? They look at you as if you're some kind of strange alien being.
You're
you
right.
Know?
And also the larger bookstores are built upon this marketing model. So, right. You know, your new releases, every time there's a Dan Brown book, it takes up 10 shelves in the front.
Which
right?
drives me mad.
It does. And so you will find a D.H. Lawrence, mm-hmm. but it's buried in the literature section.
Or
far
in
away, or in
section.
Some other section,
yeah.
children's but literature, you can find it anywhere these
but it's
days.
Also, you know, things that I grew up with and I thought it's essential reading, like Hemingway or Fitzgerald.
Mm.
They only know Fitzgerald because, oh, there's a new remake of Great Gatsby, is it? Okay, then it might sort of ring a bell, but otherwise, who's Scott Fitzgerald? Don't know.
But only then they want the one with Leonardo DiCaprio on the cover. I mean, you know.
It's funny you should say that, because I was in a queue somewhere, stood behind two kids who were clearly students, and they were talking about The Great Gatsby and how they had to read it as part of their university course and how it was so boring and so old-fashioned and one thing, and I just wanted to strangle them, you know. Oh dear.
No, it's fascinating with this notion.
Yeah, so here we are, three dinosaurs sitting in this room talking about dead books.
And dead writers. That's great.
Okay, let's move on.
I think that's what we should call the show. Dead writers.
Dead writers. I quite like that.
Dead okay. Writers Society.
We're speaking to Thorkar Hung. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is the Evening Edition with Richard and Uma. Joining us on the show today is actor, journalist and playwright Thorkar Hung.
In the last few years, you've been a very busy fellow, of course.
Because we're talking about dead writers and dead books.
Right.
But of course, your latest project is on the absolute cutting edge.
Mm.
It is TV, which is not on TV, which is on pay-per-view,
right.
Netflix, online jazz.
Not available in this country.
Not available in Malaysia.
Uh-huh.
Marco Polo.
Uh-huh.
How did you get involved with this? this latest iteration of Marco Polo, I should add.
Because the casting director, I'm hopeless, and I'm getting old, like I forget names, but my good friend, well, we've become good friends. She's a casting director, Canadian-Chinese casting director. She cast me in an earlier version of Marco Polo about 5-6 years ago for Hallmark.
Right.
And I filmed in Shanghai. I filmed that in Shanghai. So when Netflix was coming here to do it, and she of course immediately contacted me and said, come for the auditions. And when I went in for the auditions and met Richard and all those other fellas, John Fusco, they knew that. Okay, and then I confirmed it with the casting director, and then I'm the only one in the world who has been in two Marco Polos.
how was the whole experience? Because Netflix, as we know, have a ton of money, mm-hmm. and your previous project you were involved with Gavin Yap.
I didn't see the ton of money, but anyway, Gavin.
Mean, Gavin was less money involved, obviously, uh-huh. in that project. So now you're going to this multi-million. You know, dollar budget.
90 million or something like that.
100 million US.
Wow.
Could you see that? Could you sense that?
Gavin's film, we did it because we're all friends. We didn't get a cent for it until later we got some money, but it was so minuscule I didn't even bother to check my bank account.
Right.
We did it because we're good friends, and we had all been in a production of Harold Pinter's The Homecoming, which he directed. So he asked us to do it, and we shot, I think, Take Me to Dinner, I can't remember, maybe like 4 or 5 nights in the Coliseum, well, my scenes anyway, in the Coliseum Cafe. Mm. And with no budget, we had to wait until the Coliseum Cafe closed at 11 o'clock at night, and they cleaned up, and we were filming until like 5 in the morning, which is a whole different experience altogether from Netflix, which is like it's the only time in all the films that I've done for television or whoever. I had a body double. I was like, whoa, okay. You know, it's like I don't have to sit there for them to work out the lighting and all that kind of
fantastic.
Stuff.
Fantastic.
I had a college boy, Chinese college boy from Johor who stood in for me, and I just had to wait around until, okay, all the lighting has been adjusted and all that. And it was, I even for the first time had a hand double.
Wow.
Because at some point I had a scene with... I'm talking with Chin Han, the actor, the other actor, and we were gambling on praying mantises fighting.
Right.
And then they decided they wanted to do a pick up shots on my hand, and I was back in KL, and they rang me up and said, can you come to Johor tomorrow? And I said, I can't, I'm working for a Malaysian insider. You can't just call me up at 7:30 tonight and say, can you be here tomorrow morning? And he says, okay, photograph your hands and send it down. And I got a hand double.
Fantastic. That's what 100 million buys you, my friend.
I said, oh, I got a hand double. Great.
I pity Gavin the next time you have to work with him. You'll be like, hey, Gavin, you just can't do this to me. Get a hand up.
I managed to catch, I think you did as well, catch the first two episodes.
Saw the first two episodes last night.
Right,
yeah.
So as I'm sat there, I hear this familiar voice, obviously, and I see Patrick Teo's on screen. And then the immediate next scene, you're on screen in a very different situation. Uh-huh. How much of that can we talk about?
I can't because their contract is quite strict. I can't talk anything about what happened or what the plot is about,
right.
that kind of thing. But that scene that I think you're referring to...
It looks like you're having fun.
No. it was quite traumatic. In the sense, of course, it was the first time in possibly the only time in my life that I'll do a scene like that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I wasn't even prepared for it.
Right.
I just thought, if I'm going to show part of my body, I better go to the gym and work out. and which was what I was doing for about 1.5 to 2 months. I was going in three times a week to a gym in Taman Tun, and they kept saying, "Uncle, you want to do all this weightlifting and all that?" And then they asked my age, and then they were a bit worried about me. But then after a while, they realized, "Oh, okay, I'm in fairly good shape. I can handle 2 hours of weightlifting and all that kind of stuff." But of course, I wasn't going to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I thought at least tone it up a bit. And then I went down to, because it wasn't a continuous shoot. I'll go down, shoot one scene, a couple of scenes, and come back, and then maybe a couple of weeks later I go down. And I went down and I was supposed to shoot another scene. And without any warning, they suddenly said, okay, we are shooting this scene. And I said, hello, excuse me. It's not on my schedule. They say, the other actor can't come in time. So we are substituting this scene. And at something like 1 hour's notice, it's like, okay, cold sweat breaking out and all that kind of stuff.
That's probably the best way to do it.
Yeah, exactly. You just caught off guard, in you go, done. Uh-huh.
Well, check out. Well, if you need to know what we're talking about, you need to check out the second episode of Marco Polo. It's what you need to do. So, Thor, what's next? I mean, you know, I haven't seen. It's a Netflix show, so I haven't seen all 8 remaining episodes. So I have no idea if you live or die.
I have no idea either, because we are only given the one thing they don't want leaks out of those spoilers. So we only got scenes that we were involved in.
Right.
So, but my friend Patrick, I don't know how by accident, they sent him the whole script. So I just asked Patrick, hey Patrick, do I get my head chopped off at the end? Then he said, no such scene. I said, oh, maybe there's hope. If it takes off season two, then maybe you know I'll come back. My head is still on my shoulders, and we can do it again.
Brilliant.
So what's next for you? I know you, like you said, you're working for the Malaysian Insider. You've gone back to writing full time.
Not full time. I'm just working on the first feature after a long time, because for a while I've been doing sort of ghostwriting things and all that, and I was mentally dead. But I'm doing a feature now, for them on student activism in the 1970s in University of Malaya. So
it's incredibly fitting. So
So it's. I don't know. In the next 3 days, I'm actually going to sit down in front of my computer and then try and figure out whether I can still write.
All right. Thank you very much, Thor. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No problem.
We've been speaking to Thor Kar Hung. You can find him at Scoop Books. You can see him on Showtime's Marco Polo. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.